As of July 1st, 2025, applications are open for the Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for spring 2026. Immerse yourself in the Catholic intellectual tradition and experience profound opportunities for spiritual formation in the heart of the Church. Applications close August 15th. Learn more and apply at www.thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So what we're going to do, this is the sessions this week, as you know, are all ordered around the question of just war. And so we're going there, but in terms of introduction, which is what today is, we'll do three things. One, we'll give an overview of what St. Thomas is about, since we're looking at Aquinas on just war. We'll start with the big picture of Aquinas. Then we'll look at fundamental principles which inform anything that Aquinas says related to action, culture, reality itself. And then we'll tie that into charity with an eye towards culminating in the question of just war later on this week more explicitly. So today, the heart of what we're doing is introduction and an overview of charity. Now, what I did, as you saw, I didn't assign a lot of reading because I encourage reading this very carefully. So that's why. Now, what I hope to do today, in some ways, we could have begun reading after doing what we're going to do now, but be that as it may, maybe in light of what I say today, some of you will know most, if not all of it. Some will find it not so familiar. But regardless, we will do principles and then get into the text in tandem. And I also realize that some of you come from different backgrounds. Some of you are finishing doctorates. Some of you are in graduate master's programs. Some of you are advanced undergrads. And some of you maybe even have multiple doctorates, et cetera. We have great esteemed professors here. So I'm shooting for something in the middle. So if you find it too sublime, which I hope you don't, that's my fault. And if you find it too boring, well, that's because you're very smart. So
good. Okay.
Good. So what is St. Thomas about? So many people say that Thomas Aquinas, or regard Thomas Aquinas, is almost like an encyclopedia. And the Summa Theologiae, which is his magnum opus, is regarded almost as an incomplete, we know, he didn't finish it, but it's an incomplete handbook that goes over all of the possible imaginable questions that Christian theologians can ask. And there's an element of truth to this. He says at the beginning of the Summa that he's trying to do something new. He doesn't think that up until the Summa Theologiae, there has been a work that is properly proportioned or useful, literally utile, for the needs of beginners. And so in the Summa, he's trying to present a comprehensive summary of the entirety of the Christian religion. And yet, if we just approach the Summa as a handbook or an encyclopedia, we're interested in sins, we go to the middle part, we're interested in Jesus, we jump to the back. Does God exist? Probably. Let's look at the first part. That would not enable us to benefit from what St. Thomas is doing. Because St. Thomas, as he says again and again and again, particularly at the beginning, this is an integral work, which means everything that comes after presupposes what came before. And so to really get what Aquinas is about, we have to start at the beginning and look at the broad context to appreciate a particular part in that context. One of my friends and theologians I admire very much, Father Bonino, likes to say that if Aquinas had not been a theologian or a philosopher, he would have been an architect because he's a master of order. So let's start there. Thomism and Thomas Aquinas is what I like to call intellectual monasticism. This is a metaphor, of course. But if someone were to ask, what is Thomism? That's the definition I give them. It's not a particular doctrine. Well, it's a distinction between potency and act, or it's that, the grace of union versus the created grace in the soul of Christ. No. This is the form. This is the essence of what Thomas is about. And in order to explain what I mean by that, let's step back into history. So we know that one of the great graces from God in the history of Western culture was Western monasticism, St. Benedict, Benedictine monasticism. And what does St. Benedict and Benedictine monasticism do? It provides an ordered structure to all of reality in three dimensions, we could say. By that, I mean, if you go to France, go to one of the old monasteries where the monks still are, you cannot approach the facade of the monastery and not be overwhelmed with the fact this is different. People are dressed differently. The sound, the ambience is different. The architecture is different. Time is different. The bell, prayer at this time, the chapel in this place, the library in this place, the refectory in that place. Monasticism originates from the fact that God is the principle of all things, and even in this life, God can provide order for all things, space, time, and the human person. And as we know, Benedictine monasticism, its motto, you know, ora et labora, prayer and work. And we know what monasticism has done is it really shaped European history. That order, often in the countryside or in the wilderness, sometimes in the city, but often outside, changed, and sometimes even the geographic shape of the area, because the monks for centuries were working and praying and teaching the people, and the people that changed society. God as the center geographically of a place, architecturally of a building, temporally punctuating time, and the focus of the monks' thought, that changed things. Order changes things, order around God. Then you get St. Dominic, founder of the Order of Preachers, of which St. Thomas was a member. And what did Dominic do? St. Dominic was not a monk, of course. He was a canon. And yet there was a monastic rhythm that he followed. And rather than monasteries, he has Dominican priories. That's what the Dominican House of Studies is. And there, too, you see this is different. This is not a Starbucks. There's something distinctive about this. You see people dressed like peculiarly. Also time, prayer, chapel in the center, building, focus, emphasis. Everything in the priory, like everything in the monastery, has an order, and it's all around God. So we say three dimensions, time, space, God. Okay. What I propose is that St. Thomas took what Benedict did for Europe in general, what Dominic and his friars did for the heart of civilization in Europe, the city. Thomas does that to the heart of the human person, which is the intellect. And what Thomas does is he's an intellectual monastic, namely, just as religious life, monks, priors, abbots, structure things around God, so Thomas says, let us organize all truths, all principles, in an ordered way. And so just as in the monastery, every place, the chapel's in the center, refectory here, dormitory there, library over there. So within the Summa, what you're really approaching is something analogous to a spiritual and intellectual monastery in which every part of it reflects the wise, ordered nature of things. And that's what Aquinas is about. So that's what Thomism is. That's why we can take Thomism. There are many monasteries out there, and each monk who starts a new monastery or, you know, brings the monastery to a new place, it's different. You know, Clear Creek Monastery in Oklahoma is a little different from Fogambo, but they're connected. Similarly, all the great Thomists, those philosophers and theologians throughout history who have continued Aquinas's thought as a living tradition, have received the monastic form, the intellectual monastic form of Aquinas' principles, and then they, for their own time and their own place, and particularly with regard to the germane, peculiar questions of a given era, they order things. So order is supremely important. And that's why what we're doing with Just War, so we have war here, which is in the Secunda Secundae, the second part of the second part of the Summa. Of course, we're looking at Just War. That follows, it's not separate, it's like a room, a very small room or a part of a room in Aquinas' intellectual monastery, the Summa, or his roadmap of the intellectual monastery. And this is seen to be in tension with peace, which is an effect of the theological virtue of charity. Charity leads to peace. Peace is an effect of charity. And war is in tension with peace, but just war is not. So that's what we're trying to do in my sessions this week, is we're going to look at charity briefly today, but also the principles underlying all of the things that Aquinas considers. And then beginning tomorrow, we'll look at peace, and then we'll look at war, both war in an unjust sense and then war in a just sense. Okay, so that's the reason why we're doing what we're doing. Now, before we get into it, what's a principle? Very important. Principles are that from which something proceeds in any way. A principle is that from which something proceeds in any way. So all causes are principles, but not all principles are causes. Because what cause is, cause gives rise to something, and the something that it gives rise to depends upon a cause for its existence. But a principle doesn't necessarily lead to conclusions or subsequent things that depend upon it for existence. So to give an example, God is our cause and our principle. Why? Because we depend upon him to exist. So he's a principle and a cause. We proceed from him, and he's also a cause because we depend upon him for our being. However, we can draw a line and have a point here. This point, this X, is a principle of this line because the line proceeds from it. And yet, if I were to erase that point, that line could still exist. The line would not depend upon it for its existence. So it's only a principle, not a cause. Okay? Just keep that in mind because the word principle is going to appear quite often in what we say. So I just want to overview that. So when Aquinas then is treating the theological virtue of charity or anything, he's interested in first principles. And so what we want to do now, in order to fully appreciate what he does in these sections of the Summa Theologiae, is look at what's happening in reality. So here we go. We got the human person, and we have reality, or more properly, a thing. We also have God, who is the principle and the cause of all of reality. And what the theological virtue of charity is doing, like all of the virtues, both theological, faith, hope, and charity, but even the acquired and the infused moral virtues, is it is looking at how do we engage with reality, because there are different ways to engage with reality. This is what the virtues are talking about, but they're talking about it in a specific way. So in order to understand what virtues are, and then what problems in life are, vices, and complications in life, things like war, which are not necessarily vicious, there can be a just war, this is the stage on which all that Aquinas presents about Christian life and society depends. And so let's start with God. St. Thomas is very clear earlier in the Summa Theologiae and the Prima Secundae that God is the principle and cause of all that is insofar as it is good. And what he does is God in himself, God's knowledge is what he calls the eternal law. And here we have to have a more robust appreciation of law in Aquinas. Law is not just a list of rules. Law is a formality. Law is an analogical reality that's not just propositional, but we could even say ontological. So from all eternity, God knows what a tree is. God knows what an angel is, and each individual. God knows what a human person is. And God's knowledge imparts that form, that nature, to a given thing. And so when God creates and establishes reality, a thing corresponds to God's knowledge. God from all eternity knows what a tree is, and then he makes it. And that tree is true and authentically what it is, because in its very being, it reflects what God knows a tree to be. That's the eternal law. That applies to anything that is. How God knows the world to be. God's providence. Now, God is not the only knowing being in the world or reality. There's also contingent and created knowers, namely human persons and angels. We're talking about rational knowledge now. So now we got the human person. So this is not the stomach, that's the soul, okay? We have two powers of rationality. We have the intellect, by which we know, and we have the will, by which we love. And then where the soul and the body touch, so to speak, we have the sense appetites or the emotions. We could call them emotions imprecisely, but that's basically what's going on here. So you have 3 degrees of power. These are called powers of the human person. So real capacities within us. So we come into existence. And immediately, through our senses and through the process of reflection upon reality that God knows and creates, we begin, in our intellect and in our will and in our sense appetites, to be activated by these things. Like, I have little nieces and nephews. I'm very strange. So I'm adopted. I was born in Seoul, Korea, but as a young baby, I was adopted. So I have Asian, Korean genetics and an Irish-American a sense of humor. Which is very unfortunate. That's my dad. So my little nieces and nephews, it's fascinating. And I watch them. When I go home and see my little nieces and all my sisters with their kids, and I'm like, oh, look, they're entering into the natural law right now because, you know, they want to feel the grass. And if they see, they want to taste it, touch it, smell it. That's the fact that anything that they encounter is activating their powers. The act of the intellect, of course, is knowledge. The act of the will, of course, is love. Love, and the act of the sense appetites are with loving, sensing goods, sensible goods, loving particular goods. We'll get to this in a second. So, just want to get: we have powers in the human person that are activated. Here's where it gets interesting: objects. So, to make this clear, I'm sure somewhere out there there's a rock out in the yard. And let's imagine no one's thinking about it, no one's talking about it, even though we are thinking about it and talking about it. Just being there, a rock, that's only a thing. That's not an object yet. It is what it is. It's a rock. However, let's imagine all of us get out of this room. We say, you know, let's go and engage the rock. And so we go out to the rock, which doesn't change. It's still the same rock, whether we're looking at it, talking to it, thinking about it or not. But the moment that we come into the picture, these various powers can now be activated by that thing. So if we think about the rock, it becomes the thing, becomes an object of our intellect and our understanding. If we desire, love, want the rock thing, it becomes an object of our willing. And if we, with regard to sense goods, sense relatedness to the thing, it becomes an object of our sense appetites. This is very important. Objects, there's no such thing as a pure object except God. There's things, and things that are known, loved, in some way activate us. It becomes an object. Objects are describing the activation by a thing of a power of the human person. Obviously, the intellect, its objectivity, how it can be activated by things, is insofar as they are. The object of the intellect is being. Anything that is, the intellect can be activated by. That's why it's the highest. It's like the drone helicopter power. It can go at all levels. It can examine goodness. It can examine beauty. It can examine truth. It can examine unity. The intellect can understand a thing in its thingness, insofar as it is good or real being. The will, its objectivity, is goodness and any kind of goodness.
So it too has a very broad range. Anything that's good in any way, spiritual, physical, the will can be activated by it. And the sense appetites are the lowest because they're only sensible goods that can activate the sense appetites. So that's the hierarchy. So when you looked at the Summa Theologiae, the reason why Aquinas engages the subject, whether the charity is created, where does it reside, et cetera, et cetera. This is what's in the background of all of that. Okay? Very clear. So just to be clear, powers or capacities within us, intellect, will, sense, appetites are the main ones that can be activated by a thing. And when they're activating, the thing is activating the power, that thing becomes an object. And we become a subject. Objectivity and subjectivity describe what happens when an actor and an acting thing, a thing that we're, that we engage or that engages us, they come together. Okay? All right. One more thing. We notice also the fact that there's an order of specification here. Now, when you see the word species or specification, those are scary words. Species. Yeah, so scary I can't even spell it. Good. Species. That just means kind. So acts specify. They determine what kind of power is being used in what way. Objects specify what kind of act we're talking about. And objects are specified by an end. That's what you saw that in the Secunda Secundae questions on charity. So the end tells us what type of object we're dealing with. Objects tell us what kind of act we're dealing with. And acts tell us what type of power we're dealing with. Okay? Last preliminary point before we jump into the text. Looking at some of the major themes that are in Aquinas. So we have the eternal law, God's knowledge of reality. Reality corresponds to God's knowledge. It's exactly the inverse with our knowledge in terms of speculative knowledge. We're not talking about art here. So when we know something, the thing, in this case, let's say the rock, comes first. And if I understand what a rock is, rock nature, that means that the rock's form comes into my mind. My mind receives the formality, the form, the shape, the nature of the rock. It doesn't make it. God is the other way around. He needed the form of the rock in the eternal law of God's mind. He imparts it. But for us, it's the opposite. We need this first in order to understand something. And that's why truth is defined as the correspondence or the conformity of the mind to reality. Okay? And that is the foundation of the natural law. When we know the way things are, we literally think God's thoughts after him. That's truth. The rational creature's participation in the eternal law is first of all the fact that we are according, because God knows us to be this way, but then because we have an intellect, unlike some other creatures, we're uniquely endowed like the angels with an intellect, we can think God's thoughts after him. Not just existentially in our being, but formally even in our own cognition. And because of that, we can have a moral life and live in a moral society because the intellect, as the helicopter power, is able to look at all the various phenomena that we encounter under the light of faith and also under the light of reason and determine what is reasonable. You saw Aquinas, he brought up reason several times. We live by reason. Because everything that we do, even under the theological virtues, proceeds from reason. If you're going to make an act of faith, you know what you're doing. Okay, it's appropriate now. Mass is coming. I'm going to go to Mass and say, Jesus, I love you, which is actually an act of faith, hope, and charity. Every act of virtue is ordered by, shaped by reason, because reason is the highest power of the human person. Reason, therefore, governs, directs, and informs all actions that constitute human existence. And the last point is the human person is irrevocably ordered to the truth. There's no such thing as a person who's so corrupted that one day lies and nothingness perfect them. The intellect is permanently configured, oriented towards being the truth. The will is always ordered to the good. Every sin, every disorder has some good in it. It's just not a full and complete good. And the sense appetites always want sensible goodness. Okay? And all of us, therefore, moving toward the end. Last preparatory thing, I know I said that, but there's one more thing we have to do to understand what Aquinas is talking about. You notice that he talked about the charity residing in the will. Notice, you've heard it said many times, and it's true, in this life it is better to love God than to know him. Why is that? Because obviously the highest power of the human person is the intellect. It would seem that it's better to use the highest power of the human person to know the highest good. Why is the will, charity, the highest, it's better in this life to love God than to know him? It's because the will works in the opposite direction. The intellect and the will are like the two spiritual arms of the soul. The intellect reaches out to reality and pulls the form inward. The will goes outward and has contact with the good thing. It's like pizza. When you want pizza, you don't contemplate pizza. There's a good pizza sitting on there. Your will, I'm going for this. Appetites terminate in the thing itself. And the problem is we can't get the infinite goodness of God. His formality is he himself. I can't get that into my mind. Because were I to get the form of God in my mind, I would be God, which is impossible. That's why the articles of faith are so important, because they break down in bite-sized intellectual pieces the infinite sublimity of the essence of God into bite. They're true, but they're discrete truths that correspond to the one true God. The will, however, through charity, actually has real contact with God as he is. You don't need to break God down into bite-sized lovable pieces, because the will goes out, and even if it doesn't fully know what it touches, what it embraces, what it's consumed by, it can really touch God himself in a way that doesn't compromise God. Okay? So that's why, that's also underlying what Aquinas says. Now, just, I can't resist this now. Sorry, Father Andrew, after me. Not about you, but this is a joke that I tell my students in House of Studies. The intellect is very interesting because it has to work through abstraction. So if I want to know a rock through the five senses, I break down the material parts, I get the form, and the form comes into my mind, which is different. We need abstraction. If anyone ever says you're very abstract, the proper response is, why thank you? Abstraction is the highest, one of the highest forms of existence. And if we were not able to abstract, we would have what's called the Goliath problem. Because otherwise, instead of knowing a rock in a spiritual way, you would know a rock in a physical way, which means the rock would be in one's cranium. And that would have dire consequences. So if a Goliath had been a little more abstract, he would have been in a much better condition. Okay? Good. All right. So it's within this context, this is a very brief and inadequate summary of the roadmap within which war, peace, and charity operate. Okay? Good. So let us look then at question 23, some of the highlights. If you could, or you might remember, I'll read because you looked at this before, but prologues are very important in the Summa Theologiae. They've been ignored for far too long. And they give us the clues. Aquinas tells us what is going on and why he's doing what he's doing. So at the beginning of question 23 of the Secunda Secundae, which considers charity in itself, Aquinas says, in proper sequence, we must consider charity. And first, charity itself. Second, the corresponding gift of wisdom. And so about charity itself, he says there are five things. We're not getting into for the sake of time, all of them, but you know, charity itself, that's where we're at. The first thing, question 23. Then there's the object of charity. That's why we talked about that. Right. What makes this act, acts of charity, different? That's what he's talking about. What type of act is charity? And then he looks at its acts. He starts with objects. Now let's look at the different kinds of acts of charity. And then finally, he looks at the opposite vices and the precepts related thereto. It's under the opposite vices that war come into the picture. Okay. So looking at Article 1,
Aquinas is after a definition of what charity is, the third and the highest theological virtue, the theological virtue that remains in heaven. He asks, as you recall, whether charity is friendship. And he explains, he says, according to the philosopher, not every love has the character of friendship, but that love which is together with benevolence.
Benevolence.
Benevolence, when to wit we love someone as to wish good to him. Benevolence is connected with good and someone. If, however, we do not wish good to what we love, but wish its good for ourselves, thus we are said to love wine or a horse or the like, it is not love of friendship, but a kind of concupiscence, for it would be absurd to speak of having friendship for wine or for a horse. Here's the key. Yet neither does well-wishing suffice for friendship, for a certain mutual love.
Mutual love
is requisite, since friendship is between friend and friend. Mutual love. And this well-wishing is founded on some kind of communication.
Mutual love, communication.
A sharing. A benevolent communication, the communicatio benevolentiae. He's homing in, Aquinas is homing in on the definition, the essential formality, what makes charity to be what it is. And now he applies it to the relationship between God and man. He says, accordingly, since there is a communication between man and God, inasmuch as he communicates his happiness to us, some kind of friendship must needs be based on this same communication, of which it is written, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, God is faithful, by whom you are called unto the fellowship, the societatem filii eius, the society, the fellowship of his Son. The love which is based on this communication is charity. So that's what's happening here. There is, in charity, God himself, not just any good, but God himself and the divine goodness is mutually shared between God and us. That's what makes it distinct. That's why I don't like, I mean, it's fine. You often see in, you know, nice little, like your mom probably has it on the wall, as my mom does, faith, hope, and love. That's okay. But it should actually be faith, hope, and charity. Charity is a different kind, species, a different kind of love. Because we're not just talking about any goodness. We're talking about God's own proper goodness that he shares with great liberality with us. And we participate in that. And in order to participate in that, because it's God's own goodness, we have to be analogously brought up to the divine level to share in that. And that's why he explains that charity is a type of divine friendship. However, because we're dealing with God's own infinite goodness, because it's infinite and because it's God, it is not an exclusive thing. It does not restrict on itself, but expands. And that's why in the Odd Two, you recall, Aquinas says, friendship extends to a person in two ways. First, friendship extends to a person in respect of himself. And in this way, friendship never extends but to one's friends. Second, however, it extends to someone in respect of another, as when a man has friendship for a certain person, and for his sake, he loves all belonging to him, be they children, servants, or connected with him in any way. Indeed, so much do we love our friends that for their sake, we love all who belong to them. even if they hurt or hate us, so that in this way the friendship of charity extends even to our enemies, whom we love out of charity in relation to God, to whom the friendship of charity is chiefly directed. The activation of the power of the will under by grace by which we love in charity means we love God as the highest good, and because of God's goodness, we love all things because God loves them. We see this. I can remember one of my this is recorded, so hopefully good. We can turn that off on the dummy, he's out of the picture. But my sister Jamie won't listen to this. I remember one of my sisters, they're married, was dating her husband Josh. Josh is a great guy, they got 5 little kids now. And when they were dating, of course, and they're engaged, young couples, they want to share everything. At Thanksgiving, they only needed one seat because they could just sit together, on each other. I mean, that's just like that. And now they've been married for a while, so they still love each other, but it's a little different. But it's very fascinating. My sister, Jamie, she's a very smart but sensible girl. And my brother-in-law, Josh, grew up playing video games. And early in their dating relationship, Jamie was very content, my sister, to sit on the couch with him and participate in the good of video games. Not because she likes video games, but because this was something that mattered to her beloved Josh, and she entered into it. Unsurprisingly, after about 6 months of marriage, they had a heart-to-heart, and that stopped. But early on, and that's similar. That's a very mundane example, but that's what we're talking about. Charity means we love God because of God and the formality of his infinite goodness shared with us. And because of God, all that God loves, this is the difference of charity from natural love. Because of natural love, I love something's goodness because of it and only it. Because of charity, I love something because of God's goodness, because God loves it. Okay, good. Now you saw, we'll just summarize some of the other things. A lot of this is very straightforward, but we wanted to get the principles out. This is why you saw also that Aquinas emphasized the fact that charity has to be something created. Which, and you saw the objections there. The reason why we're seeing that charity is not something created. Because why? God's goodness is uncreated. And if charity is the virtue by which the will is enabled, empowered to love God in himself, because of himself, it should be proportionate to God who's uncreated. And how can you say, in Aquinas' response, as you saw, said, well, in order for us to truly receive theological charity, it has to be created because we are creatures. Another example, let's imagine one night you're in your apartment or in your dorm room and you decide to have a midnight snack. And so you're getting your favorite ice cream and your mother's homemade cookies. And all of a sudden, this is a ridiculous example, but just go with it. All of a sudden, a ghost appears. This is a very nice and happy ghost. Casper appears to you. And he says to you, I'm hungry too. And he said, well, here, I got some ice cream and cookie. And you try to give them the cookie or the ice cream. Obviously, that's not going to do anything. Why is that? It's because you're two different kinds of being. Similarly with God, the fact that God's goodness and wisdom, because of the eternal law, is so profound, he is able to proportion to fit to our will, to our power of loving, a habitus, a capacity, a power, a shaping of the power of the will that enables what comes from our will to not just be natural love, but charity. So it's because of the fact that charity signals the fact that even in our humanity, as creatures, we can be transformed by the goodness of God and enter into that. That's why it has to be something created. Because if it weren't created, it would not be able to be truly in the will. And if it's not truly in the will, then it's not truly a virtue that we actually have. And that connects us also with the fact that he said it's an accident. We remember there are two types, accidents and substance. Substance, something which is independently, an accident is something that inheres in another. So we could have hair, that's essential.
We can also have hair color. It doesn't change the nature of hair to be whether you're brown or blue or, and I was in the airport yesterday, purple. You know, that's all hair. Color doesn't matter. And so it sounds disturbing when Aquinas says that charity is an accident, because accidents sound not that important. However, accidents can be very important, even if they're not substantial. So, for example, your height, my height, is an accident. I'm a human person, whether I'm 5'10", 6'7", or 3'4". However, even though height is an accident, my life will be very different if it were 10'2", or 1'3". Accidents change us, particularly when those accidents have for their object God himself. Final thing, and then we'll open it up for questions, which you can ask if there's anything that you wanted to ask about. Aquinas emphasizes the fact that charity is, in a way, the form of all the virtues. And that's because charity places us in contact and in ordination and in a contact with God, a supernatural end. And because God is our end and we are ordered to him in our thoughts and in our actions, all of the other virtues receive their origin and their direction from the fact that we're ultimately after God as our final end. He's the final destination. So that's why it informs all other acts of virtue, prudence, justice, and even war, if it's just. Because all the other acts of virtue can also be directed in proportionately to the end in specific ways, but God is our supernatural end, is the ultimate destination, the final end. Therefore, it gives rise to all of the other actions that human persons do. Okay? Good. All right. So we have, that's a lot quickly, but again, I know that some of you are very advanced. Some of you have looked at these things, so I thought rather than looking at everything in detail this morning. But those are the key principles. So what we're doing with Just War, before we open up for prayer, we're coming into the front of the monastery, into a part of it. This was the charity section of the monastery. And then we're going into another section, peace. And then we're going into another section, war. So that's why we're doing this. It's a little unfortunate, because some people just pretend that the room exists in and of itself, but for Aquinas, it all fits together. And it's all built around principles like these.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.